Christian Medical and Dental Associations hope you enjoy today's chapel message.
Back in 1981, year of deputation, right after residency, and went to Tenwick Hospital. I'm going to take you there this morning. You can see the beautiful picture of someone's hut in the area where we lived. You can see banana trees and green grass. That area of Kenya is called the Highlands. It's over 6,800 feet high, and all the rain is based on how high you are. So if you have to live up high or you don't get enough rain to grow crops, that's why 85% of the people lived on 15% of the land in the country of Kenya. Kenya's about the size of Texas. And if you look, let's see here. This is a flight. You can see it's made up of just little farms, growing maize, keeping cows for milk, and occasionally growing tea, which was the only cash crop, and a good Kenyan tea. We built a little house after we got there, raised the funds, and about a year and a half after we got there, we moved into this house, and it was full of guests all the time. First couple years afterwards, we had people living with us 9 months out of the year because we had no guest house. So they live in our house, help out at the hospital, doctors and spouses, and that's where our kids was raised. Jody was always cooking for someone, and our little teeny kitchen in that house, you can see her there, the grocery store ladies, and I do it for Jody, so I know some of you men shop as well. It was just run over to Walmart, which, Walmart was a Creecho Grocers 2 hours away. So once a week, somebody went, and you can see Jody there unpacking the box of what she ordered. Sometimes you got what you ordered, and sometimes you got something you didn't know what it was. She ordered hamburger, and we didn't get anything because it's called mincemeat. And I could go on and on with the different terms the British use. And you can see our house help. That's Richard, part of our family, young guy that came in. Jody trained him how to cook and bake, and he would help. It was just a big job to prepare food because you had to boil water, you had to put vegetables that you bought locally, and water with some sort of antiseptic in it, and everything was very intensive. Jody was a lot out in the communities with the local women. You can see her in somebody's hut there in the fire, and she'd go out and visit and be involved in Bible studies and stuff. Up the hill, you'd see this sign as you drove in, Tenwick Hospital, "We Treat, Jesus Heals." And that was kind of our motto. It was a very busy place. This is a picture out in front of outpatients. And that day we had two little rooms, the size of a little bigger than where Lori's room is, just big enough for a bed. And there would be 300-400 patients a day waiting to be seen with all sorts of issues. The hospital was extremely crowded. We were averaging that first year 180% occupancy. We had 130 beds, and there was an average of 220 patients in the hospital. If that wasn't bad enough, each one of them had a family member with them because we only had six nurses in the hospital. So your family member helped take care of you, and actually our registered nurses, one of them was national and five of them were missionaries, they made rounds and diagnosed and treated like a nurse practitioner would because it was impossible for the physicians to see every patient every day. So we saw the most sick and the ones that they pointed us to. During the day, everybody sat outside if they could. If you found somebody in bed, you knew they were really sick. They liked to be in the sunlight. They thought it was too cold if they stayed inside, and so patients were outside. In the center of the compound was a chapel. In fact, it was built back when Dr. Sturry, the founder, in 1959, soon after he arrived. And every morning at 10 o'clock, a bell rang, and all of us stopped working. So people would go to chapel. And we had five chaplains, and they made rounds on every patient every day. There was a chapel service in maternity because the pregnant women wouldn't come down to the chapel. There was one in the isolation wards. There was one in outpatients. And I'd go read x-rays or do a procedure or something that needed to be done while people are in chapel. Soon learned very quickly, no matter how good a doctor I was, every single patient was going to die. That's true for you, that's true for me. And only as you put first things first, and that's sharing the gospel. Can you give people eternal life through God and what Jesus did on the cross? And keeping that important, because you're facing such overwhelming medical needs, and we worked very hard to meet those. But there's, is with Christ and his healing, there's no better place to present the gospel than when you're dealing with someone who has an illness in themselves or in the family. Often rounds were outside where people were, so you're walking around. This is, I can tell, when I was in residency, because I had a short coat and books in my pocket. Maybe even medical school, I don't remember. But making rounds every day was a challenge. We saw a lot of sick people. It was very much like an emergency room for the hospital. This child came in severely dehydrated. They're putting an IV in his hand. Young babies, you'd actually put them in their head. I'm just putting a cannula in the head. Drinking river water and getting diarrhea and vomiting. Also terrible burns. This child on the right had fallen into the fireplace and never been treated, and you can see they have contractures from the scars, arm clear up into the face, leg cannot be straightened. Here's a child that got scalded. They had an open fire in the hut, and the child turned over the pot on the open fire and got boiling water over them. We saw a lot of malnutrition. They got very little protein in their diet. This is marasmus. Marasmus is just lack of calories, and you can see this child is just skin and bones. The hairs, a lot of it has fallen out. The one on the left is kwashiorkor. You can tell kwashiorkor because that's protein malnourishment, and they get these huge bellies and edematous legs, and they were just eating cornmeal, and that was their staple called gimiet, white cornmeal. And he wasn't getting any protein, eggs, or anything else. And come in, we see tons of these patients. You see this child with meningitis, the head pulled back. And there was just kid after kid, adults after adults, malaria, you name it. We had a ward up the hill called Ward C, and all the buildings, it wasn't one big building, it was different buildings. Ward C is where we put our contagious patients, and that wing where you see people in front of it is the TB ward. They would be there for a month while they got injections for their TB as well as other oral medications. On the other side was the measles ward. And I never saw a case of measles when I was in residency or training in medical school. We had dozens of kids. These were the sickest of the sick, and there was a pretty high mortality rate. Nothing cures measles. You can just give supportive care. Here I'm drawing fluid out of a man's chest with TB. And he was having more and more trouble breathing. You can see his ribs are showing, and TB is a terrible disease. The hospital was very full. As I mentioned, you can see there on the left, there's three patients in a bed and the family members sleeping on the floor. One day we had 480 patients in our 130-bed hospital in the middle of an epidemic of malaria. Anybody know what the right one is? I'd never seen it either. It's a leech on the eyeball. They were swimming in the river. There was leech in, this is in the river and in the stagnant water, other areas. And a lot of diseases I'd never seen before. This was a very common one. Scabies, it's a little bug that bites, causes itching, and it can get infected. I've seen children die from scabies, just insect bites. Everybody had some sort of intestinal parasite. And in fact, usually we just treat, we didn't even check people coming in, we just treated them as they came in the door. That one on the left, that is a roundworm inside someone's appendix, which gave them appendicitis. I've never seen that. The one on the right, everybody have a good breakfast? Okay, good. The one on the right is a bowel obstruction, a big ball of worms that cause an obstruction of the bowel, and they're pulling those out of the small intestine. A lot of maternity work, most of the women delivered at home, and the Kipsigis people that we worked with had the multiple birth rate of one out of every 28 pregnancies was a set of twins, triplets, or quads. That is equals the highest levels in the world. In this country, it's about 1 in 100 deliveries is a set of twins. And so we had a lot of premature babies and the issues with those. And the women that came to the hospital often had been in labor for sometimes a number of days and a lot of C-sections. That's what I'm doing there on the right, is delivering a baby. And that's Edna Boroff. I've told stories about Edna with came there in the late 40s and delivered 18,000 babies. And that's a set of triplets that survived because she took them home and kept them in her house when they were born prematurely. Tenwick Hospital in 1982, that was a year after. I'm going to give you some data here. That time we had 3 doctors, 6 trained nurses, and a 130-bed hospital. 180% occupancy, as I mentioned. 50% of the admissions and 50% of the deaths were from preventable diseases. When you were growing up, you got your vaccinations to prevent measles and whooping cough and polio and all sorts of other diseases. And these kids didn't have that. And 50% of the deaths could have been prevented, which is a huge statistic. Now, there are 300,000 people in our catchment area. Catchment area means the area from which our patients were drawn from. Now, to put that in perspective, take all the people in Kingsport, all the people in Bristol, and all the people in Johnson City, and double it. That's how many people. But they were spread out over an area as big as the Tri-Cities, 7 counties here and 3 in Virginia, and living in huts with some little dukkha, a little store somewhere. There was no TV. There was no newspapers. There was no radio. There were no billboards. So how do you change the health of 300,000 people spread out over that with 3 doctors and 6 nurses? That's what I'm going to tell you about today. The roads were terrible. There were no nearest paved road was 30 miles away. It was an hour to drive there. We had 68 inches of rain a year, so it rained almost every day. You can see this Land Rover trying to get through the muck there. Some of you old-timers remember Susan Carter. Susan was the head of what was in the Center for Medical Missions. She was an RN nurse and was home. I was there for 2 years, went home to raise support to come back as a career missionary. And she asked when she came back, could she do something in community health? And Dr. Sturry turned to me, I was one of the 3 doctors, and said, Dave, I want you to do everything you're still doing in the hospital, but will you be the director of that and work with Susan and help her with this? Well, I'd had some public health training, but not much. I mean, we did vaccination training and all that kind of stuff in med school, but I never tried to do something in the community. And you can see that we have a logo there and our battle cry, Beer Mott Co. Low. We did some research in the community, and there was an old saying that people still used, beat the fire while it is far. That means if you don't want your house to burn down, put out the fire before it gets there. And that became our slogan. It became so popular that people would shake hands and say, Beer Mott Co. Low, not Chamagay, which actually means, do you love yourself? And they'd say, yes, I love myself very much, or I like myself. It means, are you doing okay, really? But literally, that's what it meant. But Beer Mott Co. Low became so ingrained that people would use it in their handshake. Beer Mott Co. Low, let's put out the fire, what is fire? I'll tell you how we got to that. Jody did all our drawings and stuff. There's my wife when she had that beautiful long red hair. And that I saw her on a trampoline the first time, and that was going through the air, and I flipped, and she flipped, and so, but Jody did a lot of our drawings and stuff for the program. So Susan and I began to do some research, and reading everything we could get our hands on, and getting data, we found out that Kenya had the highest population growth rate of any country in the world. 4.1%. This is back in the early 1980s. You can see their name there at the top, 4.1%. The next highest was, of all places, Saudi Arabia, 3.4%. So overpopulation was an issue. The problem was there were more and more people, and there wasn't more and more land, and they were all agricultural-based, so you're getting less and less space to grow crops on or grow cattle on, and that was contributing to malnutrition. I'm not going to talk about how we dealt with that. That's a whole different story. We went and visited other places where they were starting community health. This was kind of a new concept. And we visited them with a huge survey we took. And we asked question after question. I remember I said, well, how often do you use supervision of your volunteer community health workers? Well, we do it once a month. Every month? Well, not every month. Well, why not every month? Well, sometimes the Land Rover's broken. Okay, what other reasons? Well, sometimes a bishop needs a Land Rover. And all of a sudden I realized, you know what the problem was? The problem was the Land Rover. Now that helped us structure ours different, and I'll talk about that. But we picked everybody's brains of the few programs that were in the country, took a week and visited places, trying to make sure we solved the problems everyone was having before we started our program. And then the big issue for us was, how are we going to pay for this? I mean, we were going to have to hire staff to work with us, and all the issues there, and vehicles, and other things that we were going to need. And one day, God intervened. I was at the hospital, only one there that day, running from pillar to coast. One of the staff came to me and said, "Dr. Stevens, somebody in outpatients wants to speak to you." And I said, "I'm sorry, tell him I'm too busy, I can't do it." He said, "But it's a Mzungu." I said, "Mzungu, that's a white man. Nobody just dropped by our hospital in the middle of nowhere." And I said, "Well, I'll be up there in a few minutes." And that person is sitting there on the left, Dr. Sturries in the middle. It was Mark Jacobson. He had did residency in internal medicine. They went to Johns Hopkins and did public health. They had gotten a grant from USAID, some of your tax dollars from back in those days, or your grandparents' back tax dollars. And they were concerned about the population growth, and they wanted to do community-based distribution of family planning supplies. And he came to our door with some of the best expertise in the world, Johns Hopkins School of International Health, with funding for us, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, we had plugged in to one of the best groups we could have worked with and the funding that we needed. So here's what we did. The first step is to organize the community. We go into a community and develop a community health committee. We might get the assistant chief, a school teacher, other people that are leaders in the community, and we would go in and begin to train them. And we train them using psychosocial methods, and I'll talk more about that. The best way to learn is not getting a lecture, like I'm giving you right now. It's giving someone to discover it on their own, and we'll talk about that more. So we find 10 or 15 leaders who would take a responsibility for health. Their next job was to identify, recruit, encourage, for how they wanted to do it, seven people from their community that would give 3 to 4 half days a week to visit homes in their community to teach better health practices. And initially, they were 7 from each village. Now, why do I have that read as helpers instead of workers? Workers get paid, helpers don't. We were looking for volunteers, and we'll talk about some of the blessings and challenges of that. We did training for the health helpers, 2 weeks, a break for 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks more. It was done at a non-hospital site, so they didn't appear like that now that they were hospital staff. We use group dynamics and hands-on learning, psychosocial teaching methods, which are stories and songs and dramas. Let me give you an example of that. That would be, if we're going to teach about clean water, we might dig a ditch down the hill and put down a tree and say, this is the Yongoros River. And somebody comes out and they have knocking mud into the river where they're pouring a barrel of water down that while they're doing the drama. And then somebody comes and they have, looks like that they pee in the river. Somebody's got a blanket and a bottle underneath and everybody's getting embarrassed. And then somebody comes and has diarrhea by the river. They're squatting down. And then somebody comes and gets a drink and they get sick and they are rushing them off to the hospital. And then you sit people down and say, "What did you see?" Everybody says what they say. Well, what was the problem? All sorts of things. Somebody might say there was too much sugar in the tea this morning or whatever. Somebody says, "I think the water was dirty." Everybody, "Yeah, the water's dirty. That's the problem." Well, how do you clean the water? And you take them over and show them how to boil water and put it in a container with a lid on it and all that rest to have a clean water source. That is psychosocial teaching method. It may take 45 minutes to an hour. They'll never forget it, and they'll tell everybody they know about it when they go back because it was funny and it told a story. And then the health helpers would practice what they learned at home during their two-week break, and they may encourage them to draw a map of their area, identify 100 homes next to theirs, change their health practices in their own home so they could be an example. And every home that they in our area had an average of 7 people in it. Some of them are much bigger, some smaller, but an average of 7. So they are going to be responsible for 700 people. 50% of the time learning to teach prevention. Prevention, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Building a latrine, how to use it, keep it clean, how to get clean water, how to do burn prevention with a raised fireplace made out of mud and stones. How the need for immunization and getting their children immunized, prenatal care, rubbish pits, hanging wires. And a hanging wire is, it's a clothesline. People would put their clothes on the ground to dry. They get scabies parasites on it and get scabies. So let's get a wire, put it between two trees. Seems very basic, but nobody was doing it. And solving family disputes, parasite prevention, 24 different topics they learned how to teach it. And then 25% of the time learning to treat the 10 most common diseases. So we actually gave them medications to do that. And 25% of their time sharing their faith. I would tell our health helpers when I was helping train them, there's no better place to share the gospel than when you're helping someone to dig a latrine. Because you are showing the gospel, you're showing love, and or when you're helping them with other issues. We took three staff members, you can see three guys there, out of the hospital. They were medicine dispensers, people we had trained to dispense medicine, so some of the smarter staff. A girl to be the office manager, myself, with that great afro that you can see there, and Susan. We were the first mission hospital to have computers that I know of, and I had a ham radio. I was a ham radio operator, got in contact with somebody out in Colorado whose parents had actually lived in my hometown, and he said, you need some computers to do what you're doing. Now, those are portable computers. That thing weighs 25 pounds. The keyboard folds up, clips onto it, and you carry it like a suitcase. But it was state-of-the-art, that K-Pro computer, and we could do lots of things with it, including printing a newspaper, creating materials, keeping all our data, and we taught our staff how to do that. So instead of buying a Land Rover, we got all the guys' Australian sheep herding bikes. These were made specifically by Suzuki for that person. You can see there's metal around the bars, so if you crash, you don't damage it as much. It's made for bad roads. And told the guys, we want you not sitting in the office and occasionally getting out. We want you out in the community 4.5 days a week doing supervision and motivation. And then they also could do, you can see he's putting what they called a cool box, a cooler, on the back because we did our immunization clinics in the community. And they could take a cool box with vaccines, road to health cards, an immunization gun. Instead of saying, people, you got to come to the hospital and get immunization, they could go under a tree at a church, at a school, and the health helpers could mobilize everybody to come in and do immunizations. We very carefully planned on the map how we were going to progress this through our whole community. And begin with, we did a survey of where are we now? So we hired a bunch of school teachers. They went to 600 homes and did a detailed survey. Do you have a latrine? Do they have water? Are they immunized? Are they doing family planning? So we had a baseline. 1/3 of those went where we had health helpers, and then for a follow-up survey every 3 years, our contract was 3 years, we would go to 2,000 homes, hire school teachers, so we weren't involved in that, and 1/3 of them went to where we worked, 1/3 of them went to where it was next to where we worked to look for spillover, neighbors saying, wow, this is great, you need to do it, and 1/3 in areas distant from where our health helpers had been to see what change had happened. Evangelism materials and created all sorts of tracts in English and the local language for discipleship as well as evangelism and, of course, teaching each person how to share the gospel. Lots of forms we had to put together. Every time when they went to home, first thing they did a survey of the home, the health helper, and are they immunized, all the questions they had asked, so they had a form, they knew where they were, what they needed to teach, and reporting forms to us. We had teaching materials. You can't see this stuff, but it was all with a little dot mixture printer. So we taught them with psychosocial teaching methods, but we gave a summary. One of those is on malaria. Another one's on malnutrition. And so here are the signs of it. Here's what you teach about it. Here's how you treat it if it's a disease. And all those things were put together for our health helpers. And then we taught them how to do things. This is how to make a slab for a latrine. You can see there's a little form with chicken wire in it. That little V area is where you squat, and here's how you dig a hole, and here's how you put it in a latrine, and your health helper could do it. This is a dish drying rack, so you don't dry your dishes on the ground. You build something off the ground, and so that we put together our medicine system. And that was a challenge because people with very little training are giving malaria medicines. You give chloroquine adult dose to a child, you'll kill them. So we did all kinds of color coding, and it was in Kipsigis in English, and we and our family planning supplies. And that was a hard sell because a woman's worth in the Kipsigis culture is based on how many children they have. If you have seven children, you become a Jebuset, a term of great respect in the tribe. Why are children important? Because those are warriors for the tribe. That comes from that tradition in the past. Tribes are fighting, and you want to create people, as many people as you can. So how do you come and tell a woman she needs to have fewer children? Bottom line is, you can't. So we went out and started asking questions in the community, and talking to some old men, they said, I asked, what was it like in the old days for your father, your grandfather? And they started talking about, you know, we had polygamy and it was expensive and all that kind of stuff. I think I've mentioned that to you before. And the bottom line is, they used to not sleep with one of their wives until the child she had got up to the middle of their thigh. And so we didn't talk about limiting the size of the family. We talked about spacing their children. And that's what really grew what we were doing. You can see the color coding on the packets and a big box that we'd make for them, storage there in our office, the lower part of that, but a box where they stored their medicine, how to keep an inventory, how to make sure people were using the medicines rightly, cough medicine being prepared. Then going out in the community and begin training the health help, the health committees. And here you can see we would hand them a bunch of things on a card and some blank cards, and it'd be man or women. For your health helpers, married or unmarried, and there's a card for each one of those. And they'd take those and talk about it in small groups and then come to a decision, this is what we want. They want them to be honest. They want to be over 25 years of age. And they need to have a 7th grade education, be able to read and write. And they would sometimes come up with things we didn't have and then make a card for that. So they were making the decision and looking for the right people. Susan was often involved in this and some of our national staff. You can see some of the training going on, maybe in a schoolroom or somewhere in their local community. And we got in later days to actually teach about marriage. There was a lot of wife abuse for men and talking about a Christian marriage. And you can see one of our staff there talking about how marriage and God in the center and lots of humility and conversations and stuff. And here you can see someone, they're doing a play out, and we had songs and all sorts of things. And then we trained our health helpers, and they headed out in the community. And you see them going down the path, and here you can see it giving cough medicine to a sick child, here explaining the gospel to someone. We did immunization clinics, and this is a visiting nurse that went out with that, and he's got an immunization gun. You can give a lot of immunizations with an immunization gun. Bang, bang, bang. Well, baby clinics, that's called a hanging scale. You can see there's a cloth, and above it's a scale, and you put the baby in the cloth and hang them up there, and you can get their weight. One of the big issues in working with volunteers is how do you motivate them? How do you motivate them? And God never wastes anything. When I was at Asbury my first year, somebody said, you should go and sell books with Southwestern. It was called Southwestern Company then. Selling family Bibles door to door and Bible commentaries and topical stuff. And now it still goes on. It's educational materials they do now. And every day I went out 12 and a half hours a day, 6 days a week, knocking on doors, selling books. And I started thinking, how did they motivate us? Every Sunday we got together, there was motivation. They published what our outputs were and who was the top salesman and all that kind of stuff. We had a pie in the eye contest 1 week, and every who got to the goal they had better than the person, another person, another salesman, you got to put a pie in their face and all sorts of things. And I read a book called In Search of Excellence, how some of the best companies in the world motivate their staff, and I won't get into all that. You can go to the Global Missions Health Conference, and I'll be talking about it this year. But the basic motivators are this: creating a sense of pride. What I'm doing is important, and people appreciate it. I'm doing something worthwhile. You notice with our health helpers, that was in that red is a flight bag from TWA. TWA went bankrupt. They had these bright red, orange kind of, you could see these things clear across the valley. And that became the key thing to see when you knew a health helper was coming. We got a button-making machine, and we could make buttons and have them say anything. And this says, Tortatitaptitilindo. That means I'm a helper of health, and there's our logo on it. We used them for advertisement. This one says, plan the children you want. See your health helper. And then we motivate. When you graduated from college, what happened? You got a diploma or high school or whatever it was, and they did it in front of a lot of people, and there was a lot of cheering, and it was a big occasion. It's all you got was a piece of paper. It's what you give, not how you. It's how you give it, not what you give. And we created a diploma for health helpers. We get the highest ranked government official we had to come in and hand it to them. And I signed it, and Susan signed it, and we invited their families in, and we helped bring them in so they could see what was going on, and they graduated from, put a gold seal and a red ribbon, and they graduated in front of everybody. That's a motivator. This is important. Nobody had anything like this. And we presented it with everybody there, all the health helpers, all the staff, and people from the community, and did that even out in Maasai when we moved out into that area. You can see this Maasai woman getting her certificate. You can see everybody very proud with their bags and their buttons, and they're off to head out into the community. But we also wanted to motivate the community and give them a sense of pride and importance, and we created what's called a healthy home certificate. Kichama Gay and Ga, we are well in our home. If they change five behaviors, the chief would call them up at the Baraza, the big town meeting of that area, and hand this to them and laud them on the fact that they now had a healthy home, and people would stick it up. We started with something very plain, and then we got fancy certificates that looked like they came from some institution, and present them, and people would use that to be an advertisement. People come over and say, wow, where'd you get that? What's that for? Oh, that's because we have a healthy home. And what are you doing? Well, we have clean water, and we have, you know. So it was an advertisement as well as an award, and that was a motivator. I'm just giving you a few of them. Excellent communication up and down between the health helpers, the committees, and us. We printed a newspaper every month. Why would you read a newspaper? Well, if there's an article in there about somebody you knew, you'd probably go get the newspaper, right? Every month there was an article for every site where we had a community health committee. There was something about that site in the air. Front page was from Susan. And then we put in there as well, non-threatening comparison. We listed everybody's work outputs. How many homes did they visit? How many people they share the gospel with? How many people accepted Christ? How many people built a latrine? And every month they could see how they compared with people they were working with and every other committee. Then we took each committee and let them compare. We didn't say anything about it, just put it out there. And everybody was soon trying to compete against each other. And that was competition, which is a great motivator. And then we'd have all sorts of competition. If you get to this level, you will get this reward. You'll get this recognition. I gave out hybrid seed corn. Nobody had hybrid seed corn. We had a big meeting, and all of them there, and everybody that had gotten to this certain level of home visits got called up in front and given some hybrid seeds. And then creating a sense of family. Every month I sit down with a bunch of postcards with pictures on them and wrote personal notes to somebody in every site telling them thank you, or heard your mama was sick, we're praying for you, or whatever, for a health helper in that area. If they came and got sick and came to the hospital, community health helpers went to the front of the line at the outpatient area because what they were doing was so important. We had parties, we had hubalas of all sorts of things to motivate. And getting out in the community and talking. We did this with our staff as well. We'd have competition with them, our paid staff. And then we'd have these big meetings, parties, getting togethers. This is a big Christmas party we did one year. You can see the hundreds of people. This began to grow and grow and grow, and the crowds got bigger and bigger and bigger as we were having meetings as people. We'd have supervisors and our staff into our homes, Susan, or my homes, and especially on holidays and Christmas. What you're doing is creating a sense of family, which we do here at CMDA. This is a family, and the things you do help bind you together. And one of those things is chapel. And you can see this is towards the late 90s, and then we were up to nine, I think, their supervisors and more staff. Our evangelism was so effective. The lady on the right is Dr. Sturry's wife, and she was volunteering and helping pastors deal with the church growth that they were dealing with. And I'll say this, and then we're going to finish. You can see some of this data from 84 to 89. The number of committees was up to 38. The health helpers were up to 270. The number of home visits, 66,000 that year. 3,464 new latrines, new family planning users. I say all that to say, from 1984 when we started to 1991, we had reached everyone in our area. The measles cases at the hospital almost went to zero. Our TB wards were emptied. Kids were not coming in dehydrated from diarrhea and vomiting. We began teaching others, especially our motivational techniques, because that's what really did the program, turbocharged it. The ambassador, U.S. ambassador, came to see the program. People from 24 other countries came to see the program and learn the techniques. That's not to pat ourselves on the back. It was just God did more than we ever imagined. So what's the point of this? You live in a community. You got next door neighbors. Don't wait for people to come to us, but go to them. Go into all the world. Lord's been convicting about this and our little community over in Ashwood. 2 Corinthians 5:20, we are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God were making his appeal through us. It's easy to go to church and other Christians, but what about going to people in your community? Invite them over. Gene and I have been talking about having a picnic for everybody on our block, and we're going to try to get that scheduled where we invite them up, we get to know people, we reach out to them, and then look to where you can meet their needs. How can I meet somebody in my community or where I shop or whatever? How can I reach out to them? For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Ephesians 2:10. Meet the needs in their lives. It may just be a listening ear. It may be praying for them in a situation. It may be mowing the lawn because they went on vacation. How can you build relationship? You know the best place to build relationship is inviting people into your house. Your closest relationships with people that you entertain in your home. Be a simple meal. The meal doesn't make much difference. It's the fact that you've had them in your home. And as Galatians 5:14 says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And through that, you build a relationship, you build trust, and you build the opportunity to share the gospel. It doesn't have to be pulling out the four spiritual laws. Just tell what God's done in your life. Just share how you came to Christ. Just share how important it was. We get to a point maybe where you invite them to church. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. These type of principles work here. It's not people need latrines or clean water or whatever, but people need a listening ear. Everybody's got their problems. They got their issues. They got their childhood issues. How can you better reach out? That's the question I'm asking myself, and it's a question that we need to as well. We're out of time. I'm going to go ahead and have a word of prayer. But let's pray about God, what God wants us to do. As you bow your head, it's so easy to be comfortable. It's so easy. I went to work, and we're involved in ministry here. But each of us are on a mission field. It's the people around us that we meet in the store. It's the people that we live on our block or our area in the country. Dear Heavenly Father, we want to be faithful servants. We want to be your helpers to spread the gospel. Lord, light a fire in each one of our hearts. May we be a point of meeting needs in someone's lives, even this week or next week. Help us to reach out and then have the opportunity to point them to you. And then may your Holy Spirit work in their heart, and may they come into a personal relationship with you. And we'll give you praise in your Son's name. Amen.